Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever is appropriate to the person I'm speaking to who is listening to this conversation today. My name is Rob Christie. I've been involved in growth and transformation for decades. During that journey, I've had the privilege of working with a number of top teachers, and I'm with one of them this morning. He's my dear friend, Jim Hamilton. He's the author of 5 books, and even more importantly than that, he's perfected several technologies that have been proven time and time again to support any person interested in moving up the map of consciousness and improving their life circumstances. Earlier today, we were talking about the concept of exponential multipliers, those wonderful creations that have the possibility of impacting people in the world many, many times what you might think. And one of those exponential multipliers is known as the Maharishi effect. So, Jim, would you share your thoughts about that with our audience?
Well, Rob, again, great to be here. I always like our conversations. You always bring a spin on our stuff that delivers more, not only for me, but for everybody. The Maharishi effect is a very, very, very special concept. And I would say for the most part, it is unknown. And maybe people know who Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was. I don't know what year he passed, but he was the guru that the Beatles discovered in the 60s. And all those gurus, they've studied all these ancient teachings and this and that, and they, of course, they come in plugged in some manner. But what Maharishi did that was so very special, and the way I see it, was he introduced meditation to the Western world as a technique, TM or transcendental meditation, for one reason, I believe, and that was to introduce that when you have a portion of a population meditating in a locale, it influences that locale. Now that became, I don't know what he called it. He certainly didn't call it the Maharishi effect, because that's kind of a generic term. But what he did was introduce meditation so that he could demonstrate that when 1% of a population is meditating in a city or a locale, it will influence that locale. Now, they did demonstrations for 30 years, and it was very common to invite criminologists, sociologists, academics, anybody interested. And of course, they worked with a lot of meditators. But what they did was they would set up demonstrations and measure the cumulative effect of meditators on crime and violence and this and that. There's one particular case from 1993. Where 4,000 experienced meditators, and I make the point that they're experienced meditators. It's not like pulling people off park benches and telling them to come sit over here for a while and hum together. When I use the word hum, I'm kind of teasing. I can tease about my own world. But what they did was, Washington, D.C. was like crime capital of the world. It's hard to believe the seat of the United States government, that right outside the door, rape and mayhem and murder and all this kind of stuff was at the incredible rate that it was. And so they chose, in fact, they actually had some kind of a facility in DC. But anyway, what they did was they brought in 4,000 experienced meditators, which was 1% of the population at the time. It was approximately 400,000 people in D.C. at the time. They invited criminologists, sociologists, academics, and on. They explained what they were going to do. They explained how they were going to do it, what they expected to see, how they were going to score it, how they were going to allow for weather and humidity. And, in the summertime, people get a little more riled up when it's hot. And the long story short was that crime dropped 23.3% in the 7th week when the most meditate, because the meditators showed up over a 7-week period. And in the 7th week, the most meditators were there and crime dropped 23.3%. I'm reminded, and I actually talked to one of the gentlemen that was part of this study. This was a number of years ago. I don't remember who it was. I actually got a hold of somebody because I was curious whether automobile accidents dropped at the same rate because crime. So, in other words, you have dissonance and you have order. And dissonance looks like so many different kinds of things. I mean, it's people arguing between themselves, it's war, it's people stealing from each other. Dissonance is disorder is just disorder. And whether you call it murder or people cheating on their whatever, it's kind of all the same. And when you ground the frequency of God into the world, which I'll explain in a minute, dissonance dissipates and order naturally takes its place. Now, the important thing about the Maharishi effect, and I discovered this on my own, is that when people meditate, experienced meditators meditate, they become empty. And what empty means is they move out of their mind. And mind's an important concept because mind is not. Most of us, we got minds, we think they're cool, but the mind is not anywhere near as fancy a tool as we think. And when you learn how to put the mind aside in meditation, the whole thing opens up because mind is really kind of a block to your connection with source. My point being, when you have 4,000 meditators meditating, which is to say they moved out of their mind, and when you move out of your mind, it's like a butterfly valve opens, like a valve opens. And so normally the mind is intact. You have this resistance because mind, time, and resistance are synonymous, in my opinion. And when you're in your mind, you've got a blockage between you and your connection with source. When you're in your mind, you move out of the mind. It's like the butterfly valve opens, and the frequency of God pours through you. And as I like to say, the frequency of God peaks out of 4,000 nervous systems, coalesces as coherence, and coherence dissipates distortion. That's how the Maharishi effect works. I didn't read that anywhere. I've discovered that through my experimentation research with core resonance, which is a fancy way to do the Maharishi effect, different subject or but the point is that when you meditate, you become empty. Meditation is a variation on allowing. The more allowing you are, the less you're in your mind. The less you're in your mind, the more innate intelligence leaks through you or expresses through you. That's how the exponential multipliers show up. So the Maharishi effect is a very interesting concept. I don't think there's really probably anything more interesting on the planet than the Maharishi effect because as we learn how to meditate together or move out of our minds as a collective. The frequency of God peaks out of our nervous system, coalesces as coherence. Coherence dissipates distortion. And as distortion disappears, we move into a coherent world. And that is not, you're not going to vote and get that. So partnering with the frequency of God is the bottom line. Our nervous system is our center for that. Our nervous system is like a living antenna system. The mind gets in the way because it blocks incoming information. That's another subject a little bit, but we move out of the mind, this connection becomes enabled, and coherence reigns. And coherence is a type of governance. And while people might think that coherence would be kind of a benign existence, actually, life starts to get exciting when you have that kind of order in your life. There's whole other realms to explore, so many more to explore beyond this low octave of dissonance and disorder. There's so much more.
Well, thanks, Jim, for that eloquent description of the Monterishi effect. Want to share with our audience, although it was not my first introduction to meditation, I found myself living in Ohio roughly a decade ago, and I had gotten away from the discipline of meditating on a regular basis, I guess. So I decided to learn TM, which is the technique that Maharishi introduced to the West. And the reason I'm sharing it this morning, the organization is still intact. This is what Jim is describing to us is not the Maharishi effect is not the only contribution this man made. The organization he created exists to this day. I was able to contact the organization when I lived in Cleveland, Ohio. And when I moved to California, just south of LA, I was able to recontact the organization here. And I mention those two things because I think if you are trying to install any discipline in your life, it's been proven time and time again that if you do it with a partner or do it in community, you've got a much better chance at sustaining the practice over time. And, you know, if you're curious, just go online and Google TM in my community, and you'll find the organization that's closest to you. In addition to the Monterishi effect, Jim, when we were discussing the general topic of exponential multipliers, although it's not a precise fit, you mentioned something very intriguing, and that was an article that you'd come in contact with called "Are Inventions Inevitable?" which kind of speaks to the same subject. And perhaps you'd like to comment on that for our audience this morning.
Sure. So actually, Core Resonance, which is my overall project, it's a three-legged stool, or has three tenets. The Maharishi effect is a very powerful concept. The map of consciousness by Dr. David Hawkins is another very powerful concept. And I found this article on my own somehow, living a magical life like I do, all the research that Core Resonance has become and represents. And the article's title, Inventions Inevitable, A Note on Social Evolution. I think that's the subtitle, A Note on Social Evolution. It was written in 1922 by two Columbia University professors. And what they did was they looked at 400 years of prior history. And I guess that takes you back to the 1600s. And what they discovered, and I think this is what they were looking for, was inventions and discoveries and processes that were discovered by multiple parties simultaneously. Because human beings, I like to say our nervous system is our center. We are receivers. In fact, if you think about it, when you look out through your eyes, you're actually sensing out through a wavelength of information that the eyes sense with. And your ears sense out. You don't realize, you know, you hear, but you sense out. Like I can be talking to you and I can listen to see what I can hear through the window at the same time. And so we sense out through our senses and we receive back. And it's this sensing out. In fact, all animals do it. You look at a little paramecium or something little in a petri dish, and they're bouncing off the walls of the dish and they're moving about and they're looking for food or whatever it is they're doing, but they're sensing out and receiving back at a very fundamental level. And the point is, sensing out and receiving back is really what we do. And we are just a fancy mechanism for that same thing. And as I like to point out, the nervous system, I'm going to get fancy here for a second. The nervous system is made out of neurons. Neurons have quite a few, all neurons have microtubules, and microtubules is the connection. All cells have microtubules, and a microtubule is like the little receiving dish that a cell has so that it gets its governance from God or from the frequency of God or innate intelligence or from the cosmos. And so all cells have a receiving portal, a little loading dock for receiving information for the governance of the cell. I say the nervous system is the center. It's made out of neurons, and neurons have far more microtubules, which actually I only learned this a few years ago. But as an early meditator, I realized after 5 or 6 years of meditating that as you quiet down, it turns out you're learning how to listen, you're learning how to sense with your nervous system. That's how this whole thing opened up for me. The idea your nervous system is a living antenna system. The brain is part of the nervous system. The brain's on overload, so you got a lot of racket and noise in a nervous system that otherwise senses at a very subtle level. Well, what these psychologists did at Columbia University and wrote this paper in 1922 was to discover and identify that human beings receive their insights from the cosmos to the point that probably all inventions and all discoveries and all processes are a product of intuitive this or that, and otherwise waking up in the middle of the night with insights, or even Thomas Edison, I think it was, would have a problem and he would take a nap with two ball bearings in his hand. And as soon as he'd fall asleep, the ball bearings would slip out of his hands. He'd wake up, he'd have the insight he was looking for, and he received it. We assume that we process and our brain processes information and the mind processes and we build our own solutions internally. We don't, we receive them. And what the Our Inventions Inevitable article identified is that I wish I had the numbers in front of me, but I don't have them even close, I don't think. 5 or 6 people invented the steamboat at the same time. Two people invented typewriters across the Atlantic from each other simultaneously. I think two people with the telegraph, they went to the patent office on the same day, unbeknownst to each other, to patent the telegraph. I don't think it was a telephone. Might have been the telephone. Calculus was invented by multiple parties simultaneously. Sunspots were discovered by multiple parties, and this is to say documented. So this is in documented history. Looking back 400 years from 1922, you could see that four people independently identified sunspots inside the same year. And they had no knowledge of each other. There was no such thing as internet or long distance or cell phones or anything like that. And you look at history in the, present time, looking at history, and you can see all the different inventions and discoveries that came in at the same time, and multiple people documented it as their own. Telescope was invented by multiple parties simultaneously. Thermometers. A great example is airplanes were invented by two people simultaneously or two parties simultaneously, unbeknownst to each other. Samuel Pierpont Langley, for which Langley Air Force Base is named. He was part of the Smithsonian. I can't tell you what year. We can find out when Orville and Wilbur Wright first flew their airplane, because it's the exact same time that Langley was using some kind of a sled thing and flying over the Potomac. I think I remember that from when I was in elementary school or high school or whatever it was. And he initially got credit for the first heavier than air aircraft, or the first heavier than air flying machine. And it turned out with documentation, and it was in his lifetime, that the Wright brothers, only 250 miles away, because they flew in I forget where they were, what beach they were
Was it
on.
Kitty Hawk, North Carolina? Was that
Thank
it?
you. That's right. But their actual offices, and they were bicycle builders, and their activities were actually in Akron, North Carolina, Akron, Ohio. But they came to Kitty Hawk to do their flying. So it was not, they were always down the street from Langley and the Smithsonian and DC and the Potomac. But it turned out that independently of each other, no knowledge of each other, they both were doing the same thing. And what that identifies to me so very powerfully is that humans are receivers. We sense out and we receive back. Some people are more high sensitivity. Some people are in more overload. The sensitivity, the insight comes in and it's gone in a second. Other people, like myself, I'm really big on documenting insights. I wake up in the middle of the night, I've got a recorder by the bed, a digital recorder. I generally transcribe all that stuff. Nowadays, I have software that transcribes it, and I collect what comes in. All my writing, actually, when all the different books, all the different things I've done, that insight comes in while I write. In fact, I trap the cosmos on paper. And my point is that the humans are receivers. Our connection with source is more real than we have any earthly idea. There's an order that everything shares as we learn how to plug into it. Not only do we become true to ourselves, but we extend the knowledge of the species. Now, that's in comparison to learning how to rob banks better or steal from each other or greed and the lower version of things. There's this altruistic component of humanity. And so through this article, our invention's inevitable, which, by the way, can be found at coreresonance.com/inventions. It's quite the discovery to realize that in our history, multiple parties discover and invent and create processes at the same time because the information comes, it's like it's broadcast to the planet. I don't exactly know how to explain it other than say multiple parties pick up the insight basically in the exact same time frame, not the same day, but this. Four people discovered sunspots in 1601 or 1604. One of them was Galileo, documenting what he discovered. And so it's important to recognize that quieting the nervous system, whether it be for the Maharishi effect or whatever, that as we quiet down our communication with this overall governance that humans and actually all of nature abides by, we need to learn how to plug back into that. And I hope we'll talk about world peace in a bit. We'll go into another segment, but it's enabling our natural state of connection with source, becoming partnered with that, becoming blended with that, that the possibility of moving past all this angst, all this disorder, all this destruction, that the species out of connection with its source, out of order with itself, because we're powerful enough to wreck our existence on this little tiny planet.